our headlines. The U.S. completes its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan nearly 20 years after its invasion. The Taliban say the country has gained complete independence. The U.S. Secretary of State says his country has suspended its diplomatic presence in Afghanistan and will conduct its operations out of Qatar. Also, Iran says the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal must have tangible results for its people. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the U.S. military has announced the departure of all of its personnel from Afghanistan, concluding a 20-year presence there that ended with the Taliban takeover of the country.
I'm here to announce the completion of our withdrawal from Afghanistan and the end of the military mission to evacuate American citizens, third country nationals, and vulnerable Afghans. The last C-17 lifted off from Hamid Karzai International Airport on August 30th, this afternoon, at 3:29 p.m. East Coast time. And the last manned aircraft is now clearing the airspace above Afghanistan.
Distinct groups of civilians, including General McKenzie admitted that the Pentagon did not get everybody who wanted to leave Afghanistan out. A senior Taliban official called the pullout of foreign forces a historic moment as celebratory gunfire was heard across the Afghan capital. The group also said the U.S. withdrawal meant that Afghanistan gained complete independence. The departure marks the first time in nearly two decades that Washington and its allies have had no troops on the ground in Afghanistan. The U.S. longest war cost the country some $2 trillion, while it lost nearly 2,000 troops since the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Political commentator Edward Corrigan says the financial burden of the U.S.'s fruitless war on Afghanistan was on the American people, who gained nothing in return for the tax they paid.
The American government spent over $2 trillion, and, you know, the only benefit that came from that were from the military contractors and the manufacturers of arms and the lobbyists who are paid by the military-industrial complex, and of course the generals who retire and the politicians who retire and get cushy jobs in the military-industrial complex. So other than that, you know, there's no benefit, except the American taxpayer is now on the hook for $2 trillion worth of debt. Much of it was borrowed. And there's also another $4 trillion that was spent foolishly in Iraq, and it has accomplished little or nothing for the Americans. You know, the people who profited from the war economy, they did well, but it's the American taxpayer and the American voter that's been duped, and they're on the hook for it. So this is, you know, the money could have been spent on many things, building infrastructure, having a publicly funded healthcare system, building educational infrastructure.
The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling on the Taliban to provide a safe passage for Afghans and foreign nationals who want to leave the country. The resolution, drafted by the United States, Britain, and France, was passed with 13 votes in favor. China and Russia abstained. The measure, however, does not mention the creation of a safe zone, which had been requested by French President Emmanuel Macron. The resolution also calls on the Taliban to allow for safe and unhindered access for the United Nations and other agencies to provide humanitarian assistance. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says his country has suspended its diplomatic presence in the Afghan capital.
As of today, we've suspended our diplomatic presence in Kabul and transferred our operations to Doha, Qatar, which will soon be formally notified to Congress. Given the uncertain security environment and political situation in Afghanistan, it was the prudent step to take. 18 days ago, the United States and our allies began our evacuation.
Blinken was speaking after the U.S. military said it had completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. He said fewer than 200 Americans remain in Afghanistan who want to leave and the U.S. will continue to try to get them out. The top American diplomat said the Taliban would need to live up to their commitments to provide freedom of travel, respect the rights of women and minorities. He urged the Taliban to not allow Afghanistan to become a base for terrorism.
And humanitarian undertaking. One of the most difficult in our nation's history.
A new report shows the Pentagon was prepared for a, quote, mass casualty event hours before Thursday's bomb attack at Afghanistan's Kabul airport. News outlet Politico has published a story citing classified discussions during a meeting between top Pentagon officials hours before the bomb attack at the Kabul airport. The officials reportedly said they were expecting a high number of casualties as risks on the ground were enormous. The Pentagon said the story is based on unlawful disclosure of sensitive information, which puts American troops underground at greater risk. The bomb blast claimed over 170 lives, including 13 U.S. military personnel. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the attack. A U.S. drone strike has killed at least 10 civilians in Afghanistan. The U.S. claims this drone targeted a suspected suicide bomber in Kabul amid recent deadly attacks in the capital claimed by Daesh. Some Afghans describe such a U.S. raid as arbitrary. Others have urged the Taliban to form a government sooner to prevent chaos in the country. Here's more.
Americans launched an airstrike in Jalalabad, and yesterday they did the same in Kabul and even confirmed that they had attacked ISIS. They do not have a legal license to carry out attacks in Afghanistan arbitrarily.
The United States was here for 20 years to serve Afghanistan, but all the infrastructure it built was temporary, not permanent. When Russia came here, it built buildings for the people and the government that still stands. But the Americans destroyed everything they built before leaving the country, just like the government they built here. A president fled before the United States left.
Our only demand from the Taliban forces is that they take control of the security of the city of Kabul so that such rocket incidents can be prevented, and they should form a government quickly so that the people of Afghanistan can leave easily.
We want the Islamic government to form their cabinet as soon as possible and for the Islamic government to start working in Afghanistan so that it can prevent this insecurity.
Well, the Iranian foreign minister says the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal must have tangible results for the Iranian people, adding that stalling the process would be unacceptable. Hossein Amir Abdullahian reiterated that the Iranian government seeks to secure the utmost rights of its people. He also noted that the U.S. is mistaken with its threatening language against Iran, adding such an approach would not yield any results. Amir Abdullahian said Tehran will follow suit if other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal negotiated with reason and logic. So far, Iran and the remaining signatories have held several rounds of talks, but made no breakthrough due to excessive U.S. demands. Tehran wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner and assure it won't leave the deal again. Iran has inaugurated the largest COVID vaccination center in its east. The new medical facility was built as the country is scrambling to contain the unabated surge of the coronavirus death toll. Yusuf Jalali reports from Mashhad.
So far, largest COVID vaccination center in east of Iran. Based in the northeastern city of Mashhad, the medical facility has the capacity to inoculate a whopping 10,000 people every day. The privately owned facility was launched with the attendance of state officials in Mashhad.
This facility offers the space and infrastructure needed to conduct the vaccination. The vaccines and vaccinators will be provided by the health ministry.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 7 million people. That's less than 10% of the population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms like the Delta variant has been killing an average of 500 Iranians every day. The new Iranian administration, led by President Raisi, has vowed to import millions of vaccines in the coming months. And Parliament says it's ready to offer any help to achieve this goal.
The President has tasked the Foreign Ministry with negotiating with different countries over the purchase of 60 million doses of COVID vaccines. We hope that this can be achieved by early October. If this happens, we could vaccinate all of the most vulnerable groups within the next 2 months.
In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Nura and Covpars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Moving on, Israeli forces have fired tear gas and live ammunition at Palestinians protesting near the buffer zone on the Gaza Strip against the years of Israeli siege of the territory. Palestinian media say several protesters were injured, three of them with live fire. Dozens of Palestinians have been wounded in anti-Israel protests since Saturday. Demonstrators say they will continue their protests until the regime lifts its crippling blockade on the people of Gaza. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shannon says Palestinians believe Israel will continue its atrocities against Gazans with the backing of some Arab states that have normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Let's take a listen.
Palestinians here believe that such Israeli attacks will continue because of the support Tel Aviv receives from Arab countries, mainly in the Persian Gulf region, who have been normalizing ties and have normalized ties with the Israeli regime and also opened embassies in both Tel Aviv and the Emirates. Palestinians feel stabbed in the back, not only by Arabs in the Persian Gulf region, but also for years, the Egyptians on the southernmost step of Gaza have been helping the Israeli regime by keeping a proxy blockade of the enclave.
Four Syrian soldiers have been killed and 15 others wounded after terrorists targeted security checkpoints in the southern city of Daraa. Syrian media reported that the terrorists also targeted some residential neighborhoods in the city, injuring civilians, including a child and her mother. The attacks undermined a Russian-brokered truce agreement that allowed some militants to leave the city for northern Syria. The Syrian army later responded by targeting terrorist hideouts in several areas with missile launchers. Muhammad Ali earlier joined us from Damascus and gave us more details about the situation in the southern Syrian city of Daraa.
The terrorist groups inside Daraa al-Balad and in other parts of Daraa countryside never stopped attacking the Syrian army positions and checkpoints since 2018. But let's speak about this period of time. In the past 2 months, there have been negotiations between the Syrian army and the terrorist groups over here. What happened was that 2 days ago, the so-called Central Negotiations Committee, which represents the various terrorist groups in Daraa al-Balad, announced the collapse of negotiations and started attacking both civilian areas in government-held parts of Daraa and also Syrian army checkpoints. Today, those terrorists attacked Syrian army checkpoints, killing four Syrian army soldiers and injuring 15 others, and they also attacked with mortar shells various parts of Daraa, also injuring and killing civilians. Now, for 2 days, in the past 2 days, they have been attacking those areas. And what the Syrian army is doing, despite the fact that the army can launch a wide military offensive and eliminate the presence of those terrorists, but because there are civilians, what the Syrian army is trying to do is to reach a deal without a military solution, peacefully end the presence of terrorists.
In Pakistan, dozens of people have come together to mark the International Day of the Victims of Enforced Disappearances. According to figures released by human rights groups, over 8,000 people have been abducted by intelligence agencies under the pretext of war on terror. Mohammed Tawri reports from Karachi.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments. Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law. The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Rafia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arrange combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Sindhi missing person, Baloch missing person, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We, the Sindhi and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons, are protesting here. Where we held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, our governor house. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation has reported a rise in hate crimes in the country last year to their highest level in more than a decade. The data submitted to the FBI by law enforcement agencies from across the country indicated nearly 7,800 hate crime incidents, the highest since 2008. That prompted the Justice Department to issue a warning about a rising security threat by white supremacist groups. Reports of such attacks on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have also been on the rise. The hate crimes against Asian Americans intensified after former President Donald Trump made inflammatory remarks blaming the COVID-19 pandemic on China. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Joe Biden and the majority of lawmakers in the U.S. don't want to talk about the occupation or the settlements. They want Palestine to remain in the background. We need to push it back to the foreground. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jess Mechanic Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government Wants Palestine to Fade from View. Don't let it. Stay tuned for more. After this much time, you can predict the mainstream news coverage when it comes to Palestine. The headlines move in well-worn cycles. During periods of overt physical violence in the region, the world pays attention. When the conventional violence recedes, so does that attention. Whenever it feels as though we are inching toward a precipice of some kind, shuffling, however, slowly toward change, the horizon blurs and it all fades from headlines once again. While missiles in flight and buildings collapsing to rubble make for engrossing evening news, the ongoing violence in occupied Palestine is far more quotidian in nature. When the explosions stop, the occupation remains. Recently, the Zionist regime began demolishing Palestinian properties in Silwan, a neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, in order to make space for a religious theme park. The baseline violence of everyday life is a malignant force of oppression that undergirds everything else, but it's not worth prime coverage, apparently, much less outrage. This time around, it felt like there was a shift in the discourse. It felt like the calls for Palestinian liberation were finally expanding beyond activist circles and independent outlets to a broader subset of the American populace. It suddenly felt a bit less fringe and sacrosanct to criticize the Zionist regime. Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization, both stated that the Zionist regime is guilty of practicing apartheid. Ali Velshi on MSNBC and John Oliver on HBO, among others, echoed those sentiments. Social media has certainly helped democratize coverage, and the various movements for social and racial justice that have risen to prominence in U.S. appear to have increased our collective awareness around oppression and strengthened withdrawal to fight it. Even though since the ceasefire, which it should be noted, held for less than a month as the Zionist regime launched air raids on Gaza again on June 15th, Palestine has once again faded to the background in mainstream media spaces. And the Biden administration is undoubtedly thrilled about this predictable development because it means they, like their predecessors, can maintain business as usual without having to answer for the inherent brutality of that business. No U.S. president has been particularly tough on the Zionist regime. Then there was Donald Trump, who stated he would be history's most pro-Israel U.S. president. And through a certain lens, he absolutely was. He recognized Al-Quds as the capital of the fake regime of Israel and moved the U.S. embassy there. He pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. He cut aid to Palestine. He helped broker the Abraham Accords. Netanyahu said Trump was the greatest friend that the Zionist regime has ever had in the White House, and he used Trump in campaign posters in 2019. That same year, it's worth noting, research by the Pew Research Center found that out of 33 countries surveyed, the fake regime of Israel was the only regime where a majority, that is 55%, approved of Trump's foreign policies. But regardless of what some U.S. presidents have said, their actions told a different story. The money, the weapons, and the vetoes of U.N. resolutions kept on flowing. In 1981, the United States provided the regime of Israel with just over $2 billion in aid. That total has steadily increased in the subsequent decades and now sits at $3.8 billion, which is part of a decade-long $38 billion deal signed in 2016. It's the largest U.S. military aid deal ever signed. Since 1972, the United States has blocked at least 53 U.N. resolutions against the fake regime of Israel. The U.S. also sells the Zionist regime more weapons than any other nation, accounting for 70.2% of its arms purchases. As buildings were crumbling to dust in Gaza, The Biden administration approved a $735 million arms sales to the Zionist regime. When violence escalated in May, President Biden, the good cop on the Zionist regime during the Obama administration, not only refused to publicly call for a ceasefire himself, but opposed the UN Security Council's attempt to do so. Biden has effusively praised the fake regime of Israel for decades, stating in 1986, were there not an Israel, the United States would have to invade an Israel to protect her interest in the region, unquote. Thus, it is not surprising that during the recent violence, his administration robotically repeated that Israel has a right to defend itself over and over while refusing to comment on whether or not Palestinians had that same right. It appears that, in this administration's eyes, the occupier can defend itself from the occupied, but not the other way around. This rhetoric is nothing new. It has been the default status for U.S. presidents since the occupation began. Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which the United Nations continually stated constitute a flagrant violation of international law, have been growing for over five decades. As the settlements expanded, the military rule that governs the Palestinian neighborhoods situated between and around the Israeli settlements grew all the more draconian and oppressive. Palestinians in the West Bank, including East al-Quds, do not have access to the same water supply, the same roads, the same electrical grids, the same food sources. Since the beginning of the occupation, another clear violation of international law, Order No. 101, has been in effect. The broad rule prohibits Palestinians from any assembly of 10 or more people and might be viewed as political in nature. This includes things like vigils and processions. The rule also prohibits Palestinians from publishing any political material without prior approval from the Zionist regime military. Violating Order No. 101 is punishable with up to 10 years in prison. There are over 592 checkpoints and roadblocks that restrict the movement of Palestinians that the Israeli Jews can pass right by. And due to a devastating blockade, life in Gaza is far worse than life in the West Bank. It is a densely populated open-air prison with poison water, rationed electricity, and a healthcare system that has been on the brink of collapse since the blockade again. 45% of the people who live in Gaza are under 15 years old, and it is reduced to rubble on a fairly regular basis. Nearly every aspect of Palestinian life in the occupied territories is defined and controlled by the fake regime of Israel's military. Joe Biden and the majority of lawmakers in the U.S. don't want to talk about the occupation or the settlements. They want Palestine to remain in the background. We need to push it back to the foreground. This administration appears to want the region to hold its current trajectory. But it should be clear to everyone at this point that the situation is not only inhumane, but entirely unsustainable. The United States of America is directly supporting a regime administering a widespread ethno-nationalist project punctuated by a brutal military occupation. American money is funding oppression. American money is being used to sustain a system that is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Activists and NGOs have done everything they can to keep the Palestinian cause alive for decades, from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to offering medical and nutritional relief, fighting for clean water, providing educational opportunities and medical care, and starting youth arts programs. All of those organizations need to continue their support, but they are facing a powerful military backed by an imperial superpower with boundless influence and a military budget larger than the next 10 countries combined. As long as the United States regime continues to offer unconditional support for the fake regime of Israel, the occupation and all its associated abuses will continue. Again, Americans, the taxpaying public of the United States, are funding this. That's why it's imperative for Americans to continue to speak out. This is an issue of human rights. If you care about oppression, justice, and freedom, then you should care about Palestine. And not only when missiles are bombing over the sky on Gaza. Sustained peace in the region means an end to the occupation. This time around, let's not let Palestine fade from the front page.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. Here is something refreshing for your thoughts. It pertains to salam or greetings, regarding which the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, has said, "The real stingy person is the one who refrains from greeting."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadri, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you as usual from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today's question is an interesting one, to say the least. And the pose of the question says, as you know, the battle that took place on the day of Ashura was near the Euphrates River. Nowhere on earth can you find a land by a river that is a desert and completely grassless, except a river that, for example, runs through the mountains because of rocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. We have all read throughout our education, our lives as Muslims, or not necessarily Muslims, we have read that plains and fertile lands always follow along rivers because of the water that is present there, naturally. The fact is that the Euphrates, like other rivers, plains and fertile lands, around the Euphrates, like Karbala, for example, there is greenery and vegetation, saying that Karbala is then covered by this greenery because there is a presence of water. Moreover, in such areas, due to the proximity to the river, the groundwater bed also forms vast aquifers, and access to water is easier than one might think. You just have to dig in the ground to get some water. Like, for example, you can maybe just be digging 4 or 5 meters to reach this groundwater. And the pose of this question mentions that in the region of Ahwaz in Iran, one of the problems actually that construction workers face when building is this very vast underground aquifer that has completely covered the city. Knowing this, couldn't then the 72 companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam then just have dug a simple 4-meter pit and then constructed a well and then have solved their problems?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are a couple of points that I need to mention answering this question. First of all, maybe the poser of these questions, they haven't been in Karbala or in a land like Karbala, because
right. There
are many cases in which you have a river, and just few kilometers away from that river you have a complete desert without any water, without
exactly
any tree, without, I mean, it's not a fruitful plain anymore. It's just a desert. And, right now, even if these people study about the city of Karbala, it's not the case that because of the fact that it's, of course, not very close to Euphrates, but it's not the case that Karbala is one of the, I mean, green cities of the world because it's close to Euphrates. Not at all. And it, I mean, it's not only Karbala. In many cities in, I mean, which are called desert, they may have a river, I mean, a few kilometers away from them. The poser of the question mentioned Iran. The same is true about many cities in Iran. I mean, let's talk about Qom, for example. In some of the places, I mean, around the city of Qom, you have, like, green trees for 1 kilometer. And then after that, you have kilometers of desert without any tree.
Right.
So we shouldn't think that, I mean, it's a misunderstanding regarding the city of Karbala, the desert of Karbala. I mean, all the people call it a desert.
Exactly.
And there is an interesting narration, for example, I mean, the narrator talk about Imam Adi alayhi salam coming from the Battle of Siffin, and then they reached the desert of Karbala. So there is no tree, there is no water. It's only a desert.
Right.
And Imam alayhi salam talks about the future. He predicts about the fact that his son Imam Hussein alayhi salam will be killed. And in all the narrations, I mean, in many narrations in which the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is mentioned, they talk about the desert. They do not talk about a jungle, for example,
right,
or
the humid jungles and the trees and the greenery.
That's the point. So this is a false understanding of the geographical conditions of the place.
Exactly, exactly. I would liken it to a farm. Have you seen a farm in Qom, for example, or in a desert area, where there's water, which the farmer himself gives to these plants? There are plants.
Yeah.
But you go literally like 15 centimeters
exactly
to any other direction, there is nothing.
Nothing.
This, it is true that there's a river, but this river doesn't go through the entire area of Karbala.
Yeah.
Or if the poser has ever seen the Nile River in Egypt,
mm-hmm,
Egypt is also
yeah
basically mostly of it a desert.
It's
not covered
line, yeah,
by greenery.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So this is the first point. The second point is also related to, I mean, geographical conditions. That is the fact that to think that when you have a river, then, like, for example, 15 kilometers from that river, if you dig the ground, you will reach water after 4 or 5 meters. This is another, I mean, misconception. In many cases, I mean, people can check it with the, I mean, scientific data on that.
Right.
In some cases, you need to, I mean, again, I'm talking about Iran. When you go to the north, there are places not that far from the Caspian Sea, but you need to dig as long as 35 meters to reach water. So this is, again, a misunderstanding that if you have a, I mean, closed river, then, you, I mean, as soon as you dig 4 or 5 meters, you will reach water. No,
the water source is not infinite of this river.
Yeah. And in many cases, when you dig 4 or 5 meters, you will reach water. But after a few hours, it will finish, and you need to wait a couple of hours for water again. So let's talk about what happened, I mean, practically speaking, in Karbala. We know that before that, let me refer to a reality which many people may neglect. And that is the fact that we are talking about, a desert with, in a very hot day. I'm not sure if people have been in Iraq even in summer. Even in summer, I mean, you cannot walk in the city a couple of hours under sun. I mean, after
you can't.
Few minutes, you need water.
Yeah.
So we are talking about the month of Muharram, of course, it was around the month of Mehr in Iran, which is the first of autumn. But still, I mean, in autumn, if you go to Karbala, you cannot walk in the streets, in the bazaar for a couple of hours.
You get shade.
Yeah, you need shade. So let's imagine that Imam, it's wrong, but for the sake of the argument, let's imagine that Imam Hussein alayhi salam and all the family members, they had water all these 10 days. But we're talking about fighting. On the 10th of Ashura, when people are fighting, even if there is no access to water for half an hour or for 1 hour, you get thirsty very soon.
Of course.
People are under the, it's a very hot day, and they are fighting. Let me give you the example of sports. And for example, Olympics. You see that after 3 minutes of wrestling, the people, they need water.
Give them a break.
Yeah. And nowadays, in soccer also, in some places where the, it's a hot day, after 30 minutes, we have the cooling break, for example. And from time to time, people come and drink water. So even if they're, imagine that they have had access to water. Imagine that only on the day of Ashura they did not have access to water because they are fighting, and they are fighting. They are not able to go to Euphrates and come back and bring water to the camp. So within that, even 3-4 hours, you will get thirsty, and that's a reality. So we shouldn't think that. Even if they have had access to water for the whole 10 days, on the day of Ashura, they were not thirsty. No, if you do not have access to water, if a six-month baby doesn't have access to water, on that hot day, after half an hour, he or she will feel thirsty and they need water. So having said that, we go to the historical books. According to the history, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for 7 days, they had access to water. And although for some, occasions, they need to fight the enemy to have access to water, but it did not lead to a very serious conflict. But from the seventh day, Umar ibn Sa'd commanded the army to prevent Imam Hussein alayhi salam's camp from reaching the Euphrates. So Umar ibn Sa'd commanded a person called Amr ibn Hajjaj Zubaydi to protect from the river with 500 people. So in these 3 days, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions, if they wanted to reach the Euphrates, they needed to have a serious conflict with the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, and it happened in many cases.
Right.
But for 3 days, they did not have, free and direct access to water. They need to fight for that. So within these 3 days, it was not necessary for Imam to dig a well, because through fighting, they could have access to water.
And I might just add, even if they had access to water, they would need a lot of water. I remember reading soldiers who went to Afghanistan or Iraq or hot regions, they were ordered every single day to at least drink 10 liters of water per person. And now you need to imagine the camp of Muhammad Hussein alayhi salam, his supporters who numbered 72 people, and the family of Imam Hussein who needed these 10 liters of water every single day at the very least. And they went around carrying their equipment, their shields, their helmets, their steel or iron swords. It was very tough to just move around.
Yeah, Imam Hussein alayhi salam were about, according to some estimations, about 200 people. So each of them, if they need 10 liters of water,
you do the math.
Yeah, 2,000 exactly. Liters of water each day. And that's another point. Each time it's been mentioned in the narrations that they could bring 20, water skins. From the Euphrates, but
only.
After fighting, they are able only to bring 20 water skins or 30. So, is it enough for 200 people for 2-3 days? Of course not.
And not about on the horses as well.
Yeah,
the war horses.
We have the horses as well. So, then we come to why Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam did not dig a well. So for 3 days they need to fight to go to the Euphrates, and they did in some cases, but they were only able to bring a few water skins. When it comes to digging a well, there are some explanations that I think we need to talk about in the following session.
Inshallah. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time, and I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن
Throughout 2011, in response to peaceful pro-democracy protests, the Bahraini government carried out a punitive and vindictive campaign of violent repression against its own citizens. Following international criticism of Manama's abuses, including the use of arbitrary arrest, torture, and unfair trials, King Hamad promised to improve things. However, a decade since the royal promise, things have worsened, as torture and the death penalty have dramatically increased in this tiny island in the Persian Gulf. In spite of rhetoric from Manama, death sentences in Bahrain have risen by over 600% in the past decade, according to a joint report by Reprieve and Bird. 51 people have been sentenced to death since the 2011 protests, while 26 men face imminent execution.
The government of Bahrain would continue such crackdowns and execute so many more people every year since 2011. They have succeeded in staying out of the public picture quite a bit over the past couple of years, being a relatively small country of a relatively little note in the international press. But that does not mean, of course, that they haven't been up to quite some shady stuff in the past, and they have been increasing this repressive policy more and more over the past couple of years.
Many of them have been convicted of terrorism-related charges commonly leveled against those who attend pro-democracy protests in the kingdom.
That's a buzzword, the magic word if you want to sentence someone to death or to imprisonment and to any other terrible punishment is accusing them of being a terrorist. That is the most famous and the most popular buzzword in both the West and in Israel and in their Arab and Islamic country allies. That exist, the Western allies that exist across the Islamic world. Everyone who opposes the status quo is called a terrorist. Everyone who opposes the concept of monarchy is called a terrorist. So this is something that we have seen over and over and over again, and it's getting tiring real fast, of course, but it is something that has proven its value in when you try to talk to the mainstream media and to the Western press. You just say, yes, okay, we have been executing these people, but don't worry, they were terrorists. So this is a propaganda stunt, a propaganda campaign that has been going on for years, and in fact has been going on for decades, and unfortunately still seems to be working.
Rights organizations have long campaigned against torture and false confessions in Bahraini prisons. The recent joint report by Reprieve and Bird has called the use of torture in Bahrain endemic, citing cases of forced confessions, electric shocks, beatings, and attempt at rape.
We have to bear in mind that these rulerships, these governments, they can stay in power only through the force of violence. They don't really know any other way. This is the same across the Arab world, in every government that is considered to be an ally of the United States and an ally of Israel, just as much as it is, of course, a truth in prisons run by Israel and run by the United States themselves. The use of torture, of what they call advanced interrogation techniques, is a very standard, unfortunately, practice for them.
Meanwhile, the United Nations Committee Against Torture has raised concerns about the widespread acceptance by judges of forced confessions in Bahrain. According to the committee, judges should review cases of convictions based solely on confessions, since many may have been based on evidence obtained through torture and ill treatment. Although the United Kingdom, Bahrain's close ally, has claimed it is opposed to the use of torture, London has continued to provide Manama with funding, which is reportedly being used to whitewash human rights abuses. According to the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, since 2012, the UK government has provided over £6.5 million of technical assistance to Bahrain's justice and security sectors. This assistance is funded in a secretive and opaque way.
A hypocritical government such as the United Kingdom has and has had for centuries, to see a government like this say on the one hand that they oppose tyranny and torture and murder and unwarranted executions, but on the other hand, backing, supporting, funding, and arming a regime like the Al Khalifa monarchy. This is unfortunately part and parcel of Western policy and has been at least since 1945. And this is unlikely to stop anytime soon unless the situation drastically changes in the West. So in that regard, it's really up to the people of Bahrain and the people of the region to resist against this tutelage of foreign colonialism and imperialism, because they will forever be backing whoever supports their colonial ambitions the best. And in this case, for Great Britain, that will be the Al Khalifa monarchy.
For those facing imminent execution, the uncertainty of knowing they could be executed at any moment is causing an inhumane strain on them and their families. According to the director of BIRD, Syed Ahmed Al-Wadai, having trained institutions that facilitated death sentences against political prisoners like Muhammad Ramadan and Hossein al-Musa, the British government has a moral obligation to speak out against this injustice before it is too late. In early 2014,